10 years ago this morning, then-mayor of New Orleans Ray Nagin ordered the first ever mandatory evacuation of his city. By the next day, 80% of New Orleans would be underwater. All told, at least 1,200 people lost their lives in what became one of the deadliest hurricanes and the single costliest natural disaster in American history. In the aftermath of the storm, the National Guard and volunteers rescued people from rooftops while national news outlets showed storm survivors waiting in the heat amid filth, no sanitation, without necessities like medication at the Superdome and the Convention Center. The government's response was criticized for lacking leadership and coordination, with many saying that race and class played a role in the slow reaction. The head of FEMA, Michael Brown, resigned within weeks, and today former Mayor Ray Nagin is serving a 10-year sentence for corruption in federal prison, but New Orleans has, to a large extent, been rebuilt since then. Our guest, Gary Rivlin, was a New York Times reporter at that time. He spent most of the year following the storm in New Orleans and Baton Rouge, tracking the recovery. As the country marks the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, his new book is called Katrina After the Flood. Gary, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, you were dispatched to the area to report soon after Katrina hit. What was your impression, just coming in as a reporter, looking around you at the time? What was your impression?
You know, it's funny. Everyone around me, all the other reporters, were just looking at that first week. Why did the levees fail? You know, it's President Bush's fault. It's the governor's fault. It's the mayor's fault. It's the fault of the people who didn't leave. There are other issues. But to me, what are they going to do? I'll never forget driving on the interstate into New Orleans, and it rises a little bit. And I just saw the city covered with water. I saw it with my own eyes. It didn't even seem real. It seemed like Steven Spielberg had, you know, ordered it up, and I was in the middle of a set or something. I just became fixated with, like, okay, eventually this water will leave. What are they going to do? 80% of their city was covered in water, 110,000 homes, 20,000 businesses, the schools are ruined, the utilities, there's no tax base, the criminal courts, the police headquarters, everything was damaged, if not, you know, destroyed. And just so that just became my fascination from the moment I arrived here.
And one common theme, as you write, is that the answers to all of those questions, in many cases, came very slowly, more slowly than people around the country, than people in New Orleans expected.
Right. There's kind of a famous moment in this one neighborhood, Lakeview, that was badly damaged after Katrina, where a group came from Northridge. That's, you know, Southern California. They had this terrible earthquake in 1994. And, you know, so this is 11 years after their earthquake. And they're telling them, like, just so you know, we're still dealing with FEMA now. We still feel like we're in recovery. And they're just like, you know, okay, well, that's just the way it goes there. It's not going to happen here. That's essentially what happened. Everything took much, much longer. Everything depended on everything else. You know, I want to come home, but are there schools? You know, I want to come home, but is there insurance money? I want to come home, but will I have a next-door neighbor? Will there be businesses in my community?
And a lot of people never did come home.
Right. Well, you know, the tragedy to me is that here it is, 10 years after Katrina. New Orleans was a city of 455,000. There are 100,000 less African Americans living in New Orleans today than prior to Katrina.
Well, let's look at the rebuilding process. That may be one of the answers as to why that is, why so many African Americans never came back. A running theme seems to have been, who was New Orleans going to be rebuilt for? And there are concerns from low-income, mostly black communities, worried that their neighborhoods would be either ignored or developed out of existence. How has that story played out in the last 10 years?
You say black low-income communities, but black middle class, black working
really?
Class, black professional class. That was the concern in, you know, much of the black community. You know, it's interesting. I think the impression people had after Katrina was that this was an equal opportunity flood that hit rich and poor, black and white alike, and there's some truth to that. But if you were a black homeowner, you were more than three times more likely to lose your home than if you were white. And it's just a matter of kind of past discrimination. The high ground was taken. You know, it wasn't until the last few decades that, you know, black home ownership was an option for many people. And so they were in the lowest lying parts of New Orleans, blacks were. And that was the part that got flooded. And the way the recovery occurred, it was not an equal opportunity recovery. There were roadblocks. There were poor policy decisions. There were people who didn't want as many blacks to return to New Orleans. Or at least they didn't want lower-income people to return to New Orleans. And they made it harder on them. And, you know, That's much of the explanation for why a decade later there's so many missing African Americans.
And one of the responses in the rebuilding seems to be that this was an opportunity to turn the city around. In fact, I'm looking at a quote you have from a developer saying, "It took a Katrina to finally turn things around." That's a quote. Was there this idea that, hey, this is a big experiment, we can do things right as we rebuild?
Right. So one thing to keep in mind is New Orleans was a city that had legendary problems the day before Katrina. Mm-hmm. The schools were in awful shape. They had one of the highest murder rates in the country, a corrupt government. And, you know, it was seen, Katrina was seen, by black and white alike, actually, as a chance to make things right. You know, there was this blue sky sense, you know, but not everyone had the same idea of what that means to make it right. Some people thought we should shrink New Orleans, tell certain neighborhoods that, I'm sorry, you're in low-lying areas, so we're not going to be able to rebuild. There was a whole movement among white uptown gentry, the old-line blue bloods, to see if could this be our opportunity to re-seize political control of New Orleans. It had been under the rule of a black mayor for like 30 years. There was a black city council majority. Would this be their chance to re-seize control? And in fact, New Orleans had an election scheduled for about 6 months after Katrina. And, you know, it was a big fight. Let's have the election now because it's a white city and we'll only let people who live here vote. And, you know, that failed. But on the other hand, the election was held a couple months later, and so the black electorate is largely scattered around the country. You know, there was an effort by the Secretary of State here in Louisiana to get addresses from FEMA, but the Bush White House wouldn't hand them over because they wanted to send them material like, okay, here's how you would vote absentee and all. So it was an election that, a very strange election where, you know, who knew who was voting? There weren't really voting places like historically they had. And so there was this big effort, like, this is our chance. There are others who saw our chance to get rid of the public hospital. New Orleans actually had the oldest public hospital in the country, Charity Hospital. It dated back to 1736. The governor of the state, a moderate Democrat, had wanted to close it before Katrina. Well, guess what? Now after Katrina, 10 years later, it is closed and it will never open. New Orleans no longer has a public hospital. Same with public housing. Same with the schools. It really was this idea that we can remake this city in our vision. Of course, there's conflicted views of what the vision should be.
We're talking to Gary Rivlin, author of Katrina After the Flood, marking the 10-year anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. Now, Gary, you're in New Orleans. How are people marking the anniversary there? I've heard ideas that this is a celebration of how far we've come since then, of our survival then. I've heard ideas that, no, this is mourning the lives lost and the slowness of the rebuilding. What's the attitude there?
Well, the official commemoration is more of a celebration. There's really a sense among the mayor and his people and the business establishment that this is a time to celebrate resiliency and how New Orleans just rebuilt itself. And, you know, and I get it. In the center of town, things are great. There are neighbors that are just thriving and, you know, bursting with energy. All these, they call them YURPS, young urban recovery professionals, came here, young people with college degrees, and there's more of a startup scene now post Katrina. There's 20% less people, but there's more restaurants than before Katrina. There's a vibrant art scene, cultural scene. And so, you know, in some ways, New Orleans is better than ever. People listening, it's for tourists, it's a great, great place to come. The problem is out in the neighborhoods in the eastern half of the city, which is to say largely the black part of the city, that's where there's a lot of suffering. And so they're hearing this, you know, mission accomplished, the recovery is behind us, which is precisely what the mayor, Mitch Landrieu, said back in May. And they're thinking, like, my God, you know, you're in the lower ninth ward and only 36% of the population is back 10 years after Katrina. You go to the seventh ward, a black working class, neighborhood, and it's maybe 50-60% back. You go to Pontchartrain Park, a black middle-class neighborhood, and, you know, 10 years after Katrina, it's maybe two-thirds, three-quarters back. New Orleans East, prosperous black community, 80% back. And you compare that to Lakeview, a white prosperous community that was hit hard by Katrina, it's 100% back. So there's a real resentment here. The one thing I left off when I was listing off New Orleans' problems prior to Katrina is they had bad racial tensions. And now it's far worse because there's almost a black narrative and a white narrative. Like, the whites, like, we all stuck together and now the city's better than ever. And the black narrative is like, well, we feel left out and you're already declaring victory and we feel like we have a long, long way to go.
I've seen commentary that Katrina set the stage for the Black Lives Matter movement today because that created the sense or highlighted the sense among black people in New Orleans and elsewhere that their lives hadn't mattered in the response.
Right. I think we all saw it. The Globe saw it, that, you know, those after the levees fell, that was Monday morning, August 29th, 2005, there's 25,000 people at the Superdome. There's another 20,000 people at the convention center, thousands of people on the highways just taking refuge on the high ground. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, finally, 5 days, finally buses started showing up en masse at the Superdome, and it wasn't until Saturday that the buses started showing up en masse at the convention center. It wasn't until Sunday, day seven, that it was clear the city, the people were out of water, they were out of food, they were just suffering. And, you know, we all saw it, the whole globe saw it, that the most powerful nation on earth, you know, had all these people stranded in a city along a river, by the way. I mean, why weren't boats being sent up? The convention center is right on the river, the Superdome's a mile or two away from the river. And there's really a sense, Ray Nagin said it himself on Nightline a week after Katrina, that, you know, would this have happened if this was Southern California, wealthy whites? And, you know, I think he had a point.
I want to ask if we've learned lessons about maybe preparing for the next disaster. I learned from your book that there had been a federal role-playing exercise preparing for exactly this disaster not that long before it. And yet, as you say, the buses, the food were slow to come, the boats never came. Are we more ready for the next big Katrina-like disaster?
Yeah, I mean, I think there have been some very good lessons after Katrina. On the negative, I would say FEMA is still FEMA. You know, you look at New York after Hurricane Sandy, New Jersey after Hurricane Sandy. We're coming up on year three. You hear the same complaints. Things are taking so long, and, you know, we're just stuck in the bureaucracy. We're waiting, while meanwhile we want to build our house. So that hasn't changed. You know, but what has changed is people's attitude, at least here in New Orleans, and I would hope in other communities that are also in harm's way. You know, now they're talking in New Orleans about having a resiliency officer, that, you know, it's really important to understand that, you know, you need to be prepared for these kind of things. That, you know, we all, as federal taxpayers, spend $14.5 billion on a shiny new flood protection system. So New Orleans is much safer today than it was prior to Katrina.
Gary, thanks a lot for joining us.
I appreciate it. Thank you much.
That was Gary Rivlin, author of Katrina After the Flood.